Welcome back to the continuation of the session on the interaction of supernova and supernova remnants with the circumstellar medium. The first speaker is Satoru Katsuta, who's going to be talking about supernova remnants interacting with the circumstellar medium.
Yeah, thank you for the introduction. My name is Satoru Katsuta from Saitama University in Japan. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to such a nice conference. Today, I would like to talk about supernova remnants interacting with the circumstellar medium. The mass loss is one of the most important ingredients to describe massive stars' evolution. And in particular, the latest mass losses toward the supernova explosion is important, especially important, because it creates circumstellar nebulae that affect supernova types and also allow us to study the nature of progenitor stars. You can see the circumstellar nebulae like this image. And the circumstellar nebulae will be first hit by the supernova blast waves and giving rise to intense emission in multi-wave lengths through which we can study the circumstellar medium and in turn the progenitor stars. And as already mentioned in the morning session, roughly 1 year after the supernova explosion, the supernova shock reaches wind blown about 100 to 1,000 years ago, years before explosion. And at 10 years after the supernova explosion, the supernova shock reaches a wind blown 1,000 to 10,000 years before the explosion. In this way, we can study the history of the mass losses by monitoring observations of supernovae. Yes. And in this talk, I would like to divide the supernova remnants into three categories. The first category is very young extragalactic supernovae with an age of 1 to 30 years old. And the second group include young galactic supernova remnants, mainly historical supernova remnants, with an age of 300 years to a few thousand years old. And the third group is evolved supernova remnants with ages of 10,000 years old or even older. And you will see signatures of circumstellar medium from all of these three categories. And also, I would like to mainly focus on X-ray observations of these objects in this talk. Yes. Okay, let me start from the extragalactic supernova remnants. So first, what can we learn from X-ray observations of supernovae? The X-ray luminosity from the circumstellar medium can be described by this equation, where the S is the index of the circumstellar density profile. So in general, we can study the density profile of the circumstellar medium by the X-ray light curves. And the ambient density profile can be converted to the mass loss rate of the progenitor stars. Yes. And the right-hand panel shows the X-ray light curves of lots of supernovae as well as supernova remnants. And if the light curve declines with t minus 1, it means that the stellar wind was steadily blown. And if the light curve declines more slowly, then it means that the winds became weaker toward the explosion. And if the decline is steeper than t minus 1, then it means the wind became stronger toward the explosion. And I should mention that the, this formula is only takes account of the emission from circumstellar medium. So to fully explain the real data, we need to consider emission from reverse shock ejector too. Okay, then the stellar wind properties can be used to infer the progenitor stars. For example, the brightest type 2N supernovae have substantial mass loss of greater than 0.01 solar mass per year. And this can be connected to the progenitor of LBB stars. And on the other hand, normal type 1B or 2B or 1C supernovae have relatively small amount of mass losses, roughly 10 times minus 5th solar masses per year. And this suggests the progenitors of Wolf-Rayet stars. And I would like to point out that an interesting discovery by Duo Kadas that X-ray bright type 2P supernovae are absent. And this suggests the mass loss rate of type 2P supernovae is less than 10 to the minus 5th solar masses per year. And this suggests the progenitor masses to be less than 19 solar masses. And this is consistent with the red supergiant problem, which is still debating. Yes, okay. And in addition to the mass loss rate of the progenitor stars, we can study the CSM geometries from X-ray time evolution. We found a remarkable spectral time temporal variation from SN 2010 JL. In the early phase, number one, the X-ray spectrum is very hard, and then the soft component emerges. And finally, the hard component disappears, leaving only the soft component. And we interpret this spectral evolution. We interpreted that this spectral evolution is due to the absorption structure of the circumstellar medium. In our interpretation, we assume torus-like circumstellar medium. And then when at the initial phase, the supernova shock radius is small, and so small that we can see the highly, heavily absorbed component only. And when the supernova burst wave radius becomes larger, we can see both direct component and heavily absorbed component. And this direct component is moderately absorbed component. And in this phase, we can see two component emission. And then finally, the forward shock exit the circumstellar medium, then we can only see the direct component, moderately absorbed component. Of course, this is not the only solution, but our model, our interpretation can reasonably explain the observed data. And a similar spectral evolution can be found for some other type 2N supernovae, including O5KD and O6JD. Yes, this spectra shows two component phase and the final phase. And on the other hand, somewhat deep SN supernova type 2N O5IP did show a little bit different kind of spectral evolution. It does show spectral softening, but it doesn't show two-component phase. Yes, the spectrum smoothly softens. And yes, and its evolution can be interpreted, explained by the circumstellar medium. That can be explained if we observe the circumstellar medium edge on. So maybe we need to consider the viewing effect to interpret the X-ray spectral evolution. I'd like to remind you that circumstellar geometry can be inferred optical spectral parametry usually. And yes, if polarization is detected, it means that it means a departure from the spherical symmetry of the emitting material, either circumstellar medium or supernova ejector. And yes, Hoffman et al. Measured spectral polarimetry for this supernova. Yes, and they found a loop-like structure in QU plane for intermediate H alpha line. And this can be interpreted, this loop-like structure suggests equatorial CSM, disk like CSM. And this feature is consistent with our interpretation. Yes. Okay, let me move on to young galactic supernova remnants. Thanks to their proximity, we can study detailed circumstellar distribution. The best known example of circumstellar medium in supernova remnants would be QSF, quasi-stationary flocculi, in Cassiopeia A. This image doesn't look like Cassie, but that's because this image was taken a half century ago. So, So anyway, this is Cassie. And yes, the QSFs have a slow velocity of less than 5 kilometers per second. And also it has strong nitrogen and helium lines. And these kinematic and abundance properties resemble Wolf-Rayet nebula, NGC-6888. And which, based on this result, Kashner and Chevalier suggested that the progenitor of Cassie would be Wolf-Rayet star. And later, fast moving nitrogen flocculi also found in Cassie. And their abundance is similar to QSF. And so, this discovery suggested that the progenitor had a thin hydrogen rich envelope at the explosion time. Then, which suggests the progenitor was late Wolf-Rayet star, late type, WN type Wolf-Rayet star. This is not definitely Wolf WC or WO type Wolf-Rayet star. G292 is one of the rare class of oxygen-rich supernova remnants, in which fast-moving oxygen knots were found. And one interesting aspect of this remnant is that it has an equatorial ring, at the center of the remnant. And the equatorial ring can be seen in X-ray and also near infrared. And yes, the abundances of this equatorial ring is roughly solar. And also the mass was estimated to be about 1.7 solar masses. And these properties are consistent with the circumstellar medium. interpretation. Okay, yes, the circumstellar environment was also supported by the shock structure. Yes, Li et al. Analyzed the edge region of these regions, and they revealed the electron density and the temperature structure, radial structure, and they compared the model, and they found that this is the density structure. The density structure is more consistent with steady wind model rather than uniform ambient density. Yes, so, and also recently, Barilao et al. Estimated the total amount of the circumstellar medium to be 14 solar masses. This is a relatively big, but still possible with the circumstellar medium. Okay, RCW89 is located close to Pulsar Wind Nebula, MSH15-52, which is a Pulsar Wind Nebula with a spin down age of 1700 years old. And yes, and optical spectroscopy have revealed nitrogen overabundance from this RCW89. And also, the supernova type was inferred to be type 1B or 1C, based on large kinematic energy to ejector mass ratio. And so, this RCW89 feature may be a red supergiant wind that was swept up by Wolf-Rayet winds. We recently performed grating spectroscopy of this RCW89. The right-hand panel shows the grating, XM Newton's grating spectrum extracted from the brightest part of RCW89. You can see lots of emission lines, including oxygen lime alpha and neon helium alpha and magnesium. And the spectrum can be fit with the solar abundance plasma. But we should know that we cannot detect nitrogen line emission due to heavy absorption. So we cannot determine the nitrogen abundance. But anyway, except for nitrogen, the solar spectrum can be fit with the solar abundance. And we also measure the Doppler velocity to be roughly 400 km per second. Away from us, yeah. And so these properties suggest that this is not supernova ejector, but it's likely to be circumstellar medium, but it's not clear if it's a red supergiant wind or a Wolf-Rayet wind. And also, we also found an interesting thermal X-ray emitting knot inside RXA 1713. This result is also presented by Fabio Acero's poster. So if you are interested in this result, please visit the poster. And yes, this knot is thermal dominated knot. And this is the HST image with the contour of X-ray intensity. And there's two bright stars close to this feature. And previously, this feature was thought to be associated with a bright Wolf-Rayet star, Wolf-Rayet 85. But it turned out that the distance is too far for them to be related. And also, there's another bright source, V915 Scorpii. This star is very bright, but it's a giant star. So it cannot, its wind velocity is too slow to, its wind velocity is too slow to produce X-ray emission. So our best guess for the moment is that this feature is, should be the circumstellar knot from the progenitor star of that created RxJ1713. And this is the XMNewton RJS spectrum from the bright enigmatic bright knot. And you can see strong nitrogen line emission as well as other lines from other elements. And the nitrogen abundance was measured to be quite high. And the velocity, the Doppler velocity is roughly 200 kilometers per second toward us. So these properties are similar to Cassie's QSF. So we think that the progenitor of this remnant may be similar to Cassie's progenitor. And even somewhat evolved remnants show nitrogen CSMs. Yes, in RCW103, we see slight nitrogen enhancement based on optical studies. And also it has H2 shells, and which might be swept up stellar wind. This remnant shows signatures of circumstellar medium. Also, Papissae have strong nitrogen enhancements in some filamentary structures, from both slowly moving and fast moving knots. And this is also similar to Cassie. Type 1A supernova remnants also sometimes show circumstellar medium. And there are only two type 1A SNR that exhibit circumstellar medium so far known. And one is Kepler's SNR. And yes, previous optical and IR observations have been revealing dense and nitrogen-rich knots in these regions. And this is should be the circumstellar medium from a progenitor system. And Chotel's et al. Specified the progenitor mass to be 5 solar masses based on the nitrogen abundance. And the progenitor may be AGB star. And we performed a high-resolution X-ray spectroscopy of this remnant using XMNewton's grating spectrometer. And we found nitrogen enhancement from the diffuse regions in addition to the concentrated knotty features. You can see relatively strong nitrogen lime alpha emission. And we confirmed high abundance of nitrogen. And we estimate the mass of the dense CSM to be 0.3 solar masses, which can be converted to the mass loss rate of 1.5 × 10⁻⁵ solar masses per year. And this is consistent with the AGB star's stellar wind. But the problem is that bright companion, surviving companion, should be detected, but which is not yet detected. That's a problem with this interpretation. And I'd like to add one more interesting aspect of this remnant, one interesting possibility that Kepler's SN might have been an overluminous type 1A supernovae. This plot compares X-ray spectra from famous young supernova remnants, Kepler in red and 0509 in blue and Tycho in black. The intensities are normalized such that silicon K alpha is equalized. And you can see that the you can see high iron to silicon line ratio for Kepler. And our spectral analysis indeed confirmed that the Kepler has a large amount of iron group elements. And if we compare the elemental abundance, elemental masses with the type 1A supernovae, then you can clearly see that Kepler's SNR is consistent with 91 like overluminous supernovae. And so to summarize, Kepler's SN is associated with circumstellar medium, and also, yes, thank you, was possibly an overluminous type 1A. These two properties are consistent with 1ACSM. One obvious difference between Kepler's SN and 1ACSM is the location of the circumstellar medium. For Kepler's SN, the location of the circumstellar medium is quite far, 2 parsec away from the progenitor star. As for type 1ACSM, the CSM radius is about 0.01 parsec. This result supports the recent argument by Lerodas et al. That overluminous 1A and 1ACSM are fundamentally the same objects. N103b has been thought to be an older cousin of Kepler's SNR. It shows dense material in the Western Hemisphere, and the H-alpha Bauschock shape assures that the optical emission is part of this remnant. And also, its IR spectrum is remarkably similar to the Kepler's SN spectrum. So all of these properties suggest the presence of the circumstellar medium. But in this case, we do not see nitrogen enhancement. So the progenitor may be not so evolved as Kepler's SN progenitor. It should be young, massive progenitor. Finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about evolved SNRs. The plasma states in supernova remnants has been thought to be either under ionization condition, which means electron temperature is greater than the ionization temperature, or in the equilibrium, in which electron temperature is equal to the ionization temperature. But this picture has changed by the Suzaku Observatory that established the over-ionization plasma in supernova remnants. The over-ionization plasma was suggested from ASCA observations, but Suzaku finally established the over-ionization plasma by the detection of this recombination, strong radiative recombination continuum. And there are two main possible formation processes of the recombination plasmas, A, adiabatic cooling, and B, thermal conduction. And in the adiabatic cooling scenario, we need a dense circumstellar medium close to the progenitor star. And if the blast wave hit the circumstellar medium, the circumstellar medium will be immediately become hot, and also the ionization is equilibrated due to its high density. And then the blast wave came out from the dense circumstellar region. The hot circumstellar medium freely expand and causing adiabatic cooling. And then electron temperature goes down, whereas the ionization temperature stays roughly constant. And then this is why we see the recombination plasma in this case. In this scenario. The other scenario, thermal conduction, can take place when the blast wave reaches dense clouds. Yeah, and the thermal energy goes into the cold cloud, which causes the recombination, over-ionized plasma. And how to distinguish the two scenarios? There's a clear observational differences expected. Yes, in the adiabatic cooling scenario, we expect a positive correlation between electron temperature and electron density. This is because in the lower ISM density region, we expect faster expansion and thus lower electron temperature. And on the other hand, in the thermal conduction cooling scenario, we expect anti-correlation between electron temperature and electron density. This is because higher density, higher ISM or ISM cloud causes lower electron temperature. And recently, for N49b, Yamaguchi-san et al. Found a positive correlation between electron temperature and electron density, which clearly favors the adiabatic cooling scenario for this remnant. And here I summarize the observational properties of recombination plasmas. So far we have 15 SNR that exhibit recombination plasmas, and out of 15 SNRs, 6 remnants are responsible for the adiabatic cooling scenario. But one problem is that the estimated masses are too big, too large for the circumstellar medium, to be circumstellar medium. So we need some fine tuning, or we need complete different interpretation. Okay, this is a summary of my talk. This supernova ejecta will first interact with the circumstellar medium created by stellar winds from a progenitor star. And emission from the supernova and the CSM interaction is an important clue to probing the circumstellar medium, and in turn, the nature of the progenitor stars. And for extragalactic supernovae, X-ray observations of these objects allow us to study mass loss rates and CSM geometries. And for young historical SNRs, detailed studies of CSM knots allow us to assess the nature of the progenitor stars. And for evolved SNRs, recombination plasmas may be the signature of the presence of massive CSM and progenitor star. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. We have time for some questions. Bill.
Thank you. Very interesting. I'm over here. Bill Blair. I know it's odd when you look out and you don't know where the sound is coming from. It happened to me, too. Very interesting stuff. I was interested in your comparison of Kepler to N103b. I just wanted to mention, in case it slips through in the literature, but it doesn't register. Kepler, of course, is almost directly toward the galactic center, almost halfway in. And so the nitrogen abundance, even in the normal ISM, will be elevated by roughly a factor 2. So I was very interested to see that nitrogen line, but it's right down at the end of the range, 6 plus or minus 3. It's probably elevated, but it may not be elevated by as much as you would otherwise think. So I just wanted to note that the galactic abundance gradient will raise the nitrogen ISM abundance at that location as well.
Yeah, OK. I will check the abundance gradient in the galaxy. Thank you for your comment.
Dan.
Satoru, that was a very nice talk. I wanted to go to your table of RRC supernova remnants.
Yes.
And you said that 6 out of 15 showed evidence for adiabatic cooling. That's about 4 in 10, which is the same number that Rafaela claimed earlier for early circumstellar interaction with supernova. So it might be that the supernova that she's observing now are the progenitors of RRC supernova remnants. I don't know if you have thought about that at all.
Oh, I didn't notice that. Thanks for your comment. Well, but as I said, the masses of circumstellar medium is too large. So I think I'm afraid. Sorry, I have a little concern about this result anyway. For example, this is, this is too big.
Jakob.
Yeah, a remark about Kepler's light curve, because Kepler's light curve looks like more like a normal type 1a. It's not as fat, as broad as So how do you reconcile that with the 1991T-like profile?
But the Kepler's light curve was obtained 400 years ago, so I think it's difficult to distinguish between overluminous type 1a and normal type 1a using the old data.
So you don't trust, because it even if you change the magnitudes by one, you don't get the very broad one that you expect from 1991T. So it may have been a lot of iron, but whether it's 1991T is not quite clear. It may be even different in that sense. I know in your review you also compared it even to a 91BG type.
Yes.
Right, because the light curve looks like that. It's very narrow. Although then it should be really underluminous, which I also don't think is correct. I know Pilar came to the same conclusion that it was a normal type 1A. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I noticed that.
I guess the answer is that Arnim, is he still here? He needs to just get the light echo of Kepler, but it's we keep on asking that for a very long time.
Yes, we need light echo. Thank you.